Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is in the matter of Lancelot Investors Fund, the Winston & Strawn appeal. Mr. Tomaszewski.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The bankruptcy trustee, Mr. Peterson, is again before you having sued professionals who failed to perform their proper professional duty, in this case to the two offshore hedge funds. And the district court here, like the district court in the McGladrey case, held that the professionals' failings were irrelevant because their clients, the funds, knew what the professionals knew through imputation of the knowledge and acts of Gregory Bell. But here, the district court erred because it focused simply on what the funds were deemed to know and failed to consider that a legal malpractice claim is about what the lawyer is supposed to do with the knowledge it has, no matter whether the client also has that knowledge. The trustee alleged that Winston committed legal malpractice in three ways in which imputed knowledge is irrelevant. First, Bell told Winston in 2005 that his management company wasn't complying with certain monitoring terms.
Why did he do that?
Excuse me?
Why did he do that?
The record doesn't show, Your Honor.
I don't get it.
Well, he told him. That was admitted.
Why did he tell him?
I don't know, Your Honor.
I think you have a serious Iqbal problem, because your case doesn't really make any sense.
Well, Your Honor,
this fellow Bell, who's a crook, he was the funds.
Your Honor, I disagree that Mr. Bell was a crook at the time in 2005.
Come on.
Your Honor, at the time in 2005, there's no evidence that he, for example, knew that the Petters was running a Ponzi scheme. What he knew was that he had a contract to do some monitoring and that it wasn't happening.
I'm sure he suspected something fishy going on. Look, who are the other directors?
The other directors were three men in the Cayman Islands who were independent directors.
What do we know about them?
They were independent directors.
What do we know about them?
We know very little about
them. I don't buy that they were independent directors. I want to know who they were, where they are.
Well, Your Honor, I'm sure that everyone would like to know that.
Look,
but this is a
12B. What bothers me is the scope of your pre-complaint investigation, because this is a case in which your case seems very fishy. It seems as if Bell totally controlled the funds, which he had created, that these other two were his patsies, and who replaced him? When he stepped down as the director of the fund?
Three men in the Cayman Islands, Your Honor.
No. There were two directors plus him. Then in 2006, I think he resigned. Who replaced him?
Another man from the Cayman Islands.
Another man about whom we know nothing.
That's right, Your Honor.
For all we know, these are just the tools of Bell.
Well, for all we know, but this is a
12B6. Well, why don't you do a pre-complaint investigation and find out who these people are? Because obviously, you know, they have bios, they have, right? If they're respectable, they're not actual criminals, right?
Your Honor, if there was an inadequate
I think the most plausible, remember, Iqbal creates the plausibility test. The most plausible reading of the case, of your complaint and the attached documents and so on, is that this fellow Bell creates these funds, appoints some kind of Cayman Island creatures to be the so-called independent directors, runs this thing, discovers you know it's a Ponzi scheme, says fine, I'll take it over, I'll do the Ponziism, and now he turns around, wants to blame all this, I mean not him, the director, on the law firm. And I say, I keep coming back to this fact, I don't understand Bell's motive in telling Winston, oh, by the way, you know, I'm not complying with the requirements of the investment.
Well, Your Honor, at the time, there was a confidential investment memorandum in place that said the investigation would take place. All right, he went to Winston to draft updated and new confidential memoranda. In the course of that, he told Winston that one of the things in the 2003 memorandum wasn't happening. That was information.
What is the purpose of telling your lawyer, I'm violating my contract? Well, I can imagine asking the lawyer to do something, but just telling the lawyer, I'm not complying with my contract?
Well, Your Honor,
what's that about?
People come to lawyers all the time with problems.
What's the problem? He tells the lawyer, I'm not complying.
One plausible explanation is that the 2003 memorandum was no longer accurate. So he gave that information to Winston, and Winston was therefore supposed to determine whether the representation needed to be taken out or whether it could be kept in.
Well, I don't understand. What? Telling them that there's false representation, saying I violated the contract, contains false representations. Now what?
Now a new confidential memorandum has to be issued. And then the question is whether the same representations needed to be made.
Did he ask Winston to draft a new contract?
Yes, Winston's job was...
No, draft a new contract that would take out this provision that he wasn't complying with.
I don't know, Your Honor, but... Again, one of our claims is that Winston took on a conflicted representation. He was representing both the company personally.
No, but that only works if there is some distinction between the funds and Bell. If the funds are entirely the tools of Bell, then there's no space between them. And I think that is the likeliest inference. There is no space. The funds are just Bell's tool. The directors are his tool. Right?
Well, once Bell revealed
No, not possible. Not quite likely. There's no space. There was never an inch of space between the funds and Bell.
Winston didn't know that.
You answer my question.
There may not have
You
been.
Answer my question.
Your Honor, there may have been a control of the funds by Bell.
Then
In fact, there was control
it,
of the funds by Bell.
What difference would it make if Winston started assuming that the funds were independent? What good would that do?
Because Winston undertook the separate representation of two clients, and when it found out that one of those clients, the management company, was breaching its contract to the other client, it had an obligation to do something about that.
Because that falls into their argument about causation, right?
Well,
if the funds are in the control of Bell, then Winston going to the funds and say, oh, you've got a problem, has nothing. That's just Bell speaking to himself, right?
Winston had no right to make the assumption
so
that
what?
If it went...
The question is the causal significance.
I agree,
you go,
Your Honor.
You go, if you went to the funds, you're going to Bell. All right, Bell comes to you and says, I'm violating this provision of the contract. So Winston goes running to the funds and say, we have learned that Bell is violating the contract. But if the funds are Bell, then there is no information of any value being communicated. They're talking to Bell. Bell tells them he's violating the contract, and in effect, they're saying to Bell, you violated the contract.
Well, Your Honor, that's a speculation, I think. And again, this is a Rule
12b-6. Yeah, it's a speculation, but I find your version of what happened implausible. That's the Iqbal standard. It's a major commercial case, and before you start getting into a lot of discovery, you're supposed to do a pre-complaint investigation. Now, there are limits on that. But surely you can find out more about these directors in the Cayman Islands and the independence of the funds than you have tried to do.
Again, Your Honor, Winston drafted confidential investment memoranda that said they were independent directors. So from Winston's perspective...
Well, of course, they may have been deceived by Bell and by the directors.
Well, Winston certainly had a professional obligation to find out whether saying they were independent directors was accurate before it drafted a confidential memorandum saying so.
I don't think so.
Well, that's our allegation, Your Honor.
Where did you get that idea from? I mean, every statement made in a contract submitted to a lawyer has to be verified factually by the law firm?
If it's important, and especially, Your Honor, if it may have seemed, if it may have seemed, if it may have seemed to the law firm that Bell was controlling everything, and then they were saying there was an independence, that's a dissonance.
Why should it seem that to the law firm?
Why should
the law firm suspect what's going on?
Well, if the law firm didn't suspect what's going on, Your Honor, then they certainly wouldn't have believed that it was useless to go to the board and tell them what was going on, and to make sure that some independent person at the board knew what was going on and was in a position to do something about it.
Maybe, but if there was no, if there were no independent directors in fact, that would have had no causal significance.
Well, it's an if, Your Honor, and again, this is a Rule 12b-6 case. There are allegations in the complaint.
You have heard of the Iqbal case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That has changed our approach to motion to dismiss, at least in commercial case. And, of course, this goes back to Twombly, too.
Your Honor, I don't think it's entirely implausible to say that something would have been done. After all, we do know for a fact, because it was admitted by the Winston partner, that Bell told him that the monitoring provisions were not being complied with. If Bell told him that the monitoring provisions were not being complied with, it's not entirely implausible to believe that had the law firm said, well, gee, then we shouldn't put that in the next offering memorandum, that that would have been taken out, and that would have created a lot of space that would have solved a lot of problems. But instead, having been told that the provisions were not being complied with, Winston drafted an investment memorandum that said they were. And that's really the heart of the problem.
How would taking it out of what? It would have warned future investors or what?
Well, if it was a material representation, and I think there's probably little doubt that it was, then one might assume that investors would not have come in if the representation hadn't been made.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You say it would frighten off investors.
That's right. And therefore, more notes wouldn't have been bought because there wasn't any money to buy the notes. I see I've gone into my rebuttal time, unless the panel has any other questions.
Certainly, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Landau.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Chris Landau, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellee, Winston and Strawn. In contrast to the other cases that the trustees brought on behalf of the bankrupt funds, this case isn't fundamentally about the Petters Ponzi scheme. Rather, this case is about the fund's own wrongdoing in deceiving their investors about the safety of their investments. The complaint's core theory is that Gregory Bell told Winston about the fund's wrongdoing, which, incidentally, we vigorously deny, and Winston was negligent by failing to blow the whistle on that wrongdoing. Even accepting the complaint's factual allegations as true, the venerable in pari delicto doctrine.
If you accept the complaint's factual allegations as true, how do we get to a pari delicto defense? Forget about the law firm for a moment. And suppose Bell had gone to an architect and said, the roof of the fund's building is very leaky, and I suspect it's going to cave in. What should we do? And the architect takes his money and doesn't solve the problem, and the roof caves in. And the funds then sue. Could the architect make a pari delicto defense by saying, but Bell knew and the funds knew that the roof was about to cave in, so we can't be liable?
No, Your Honor. That's different because...
No, because the architect has been hired to provide advice about what to do about the state of the roof. Now, as I understand the complaint, all questions about Iqbal to one side, as I understand the complaint, that's what this complaint is. It said Bell went to the law firm and said, we've got this problem. What do I do? And the law firm didn't do anything or didn't do anything constructive.
Your Honor, again, I think the point of the in pari delicto doctrine...
Did he say, what do I do?
Excuse me?
Did he say, what do I do?
No, that's not what the complaint alleges,
no.
Your Honor. The complaint just alleges that he went there and told him that they were not complying with the safeguards meant to protect their own investors. So that's one difference from the hypothetical that Your Honor posited.
That I understand. That's a different response, which is we weren't hired to do anything about that, and therefore we didn't have to do anything about that. But that's not the pare delicto problem. This case was dismissed on the ground of pare delicto, and that's what I'm trying to explore.
Absolutely. The in pare delicto doctrine, Your Honor, says that certain people are categorically barred or disabled from bringing a lawsuit against other people because they are involved in the wrongdoing, and essentially the law doesn't want them
they
to
are
shift
at least
the consequences.
As much in fault, right?
Correct.
And that's exactly the problem. If the pare delicto defense applies, then somebody, there are all sorts of people in the financial business who discover that there's something wrong. They can't hire professional assistants because one can always come back and say, well, you knew there was something wrong, therefore the person you hired to help solve the problem can take your money without doing anything.
Well, you're wrong. I think the difference is that if you discover something is wrong, that doesn't mean that you are the intentional wrongdoer. I think what's really remarkable about this case is that these folks, again, let's not lose sight of the facts here. This was a fund that was not a diversified investment fund. They had one particular investment they were doing. They were buying these Petters notes. They themselves say that what Bell told them is that they were not complying with the fundamental safeguards meant to protect the integrity of that particular single investment that the funds did. So they were telling their investors, this is a very safe investment. That's how they vacuumed up billions of dollars to put into this, by saying, we must have 150% of the collateral. We will be sure that they have the buyer. We will monitor it. This will all go into a lockbox. So the funds were presenting this to the world as a very safe investment. Allegedly, then, Gregory Bell goes to Winston, and again, we vigorously deny that he told us this, but even accepting the complaint that he did tell us this, he says, guess what? We are essentially committing fraud on our investors. We are telling the investors that there's all these safeguards in place that make this a very safe investment, but it's not. That seems to me, Judge Easterbrook, with all respect, very different than the hypothetical that you posited, which is to say sometimes somebody says, oh my gosh, we have somebody bad that's in our firm. Then you don't necessarily have an imputation. I think this goes back to some of the points that Judge Posner was making earlier, which is these funds were Bell. I mean, these funds were founded by Bell. Bell was a director of the funds at the time he allegedly told Winston, which was 2005. He stepped down from the board in 2006, but he still remained the investment manager. And it's remarkable to read the confidential investment or information memoranda. They say these funds would probably cease operating if Bell were no longer associated with the Bell investment companies. So, whereas in your hypothetical, Your Honor, there may be issues of imputation. I think this case is about the most clear-cut case where obviously Bell's knowledge has to be imputed to the funds. So there's a contradiction at the very heart of this lawsuit. They have to say for Winston to be bad.
I don't think there's any point in fighting about that. That's a holding of the prior panel's opinion, that the funds knew what Bell knew. Right, these other directors can safely be ignored. The funds and Bell are the same thing.
Okay.
Right. That's why I was asking, can somebody who's got a legal problem on his hands hire a professional, legal problem or an architectural problem, hire a professional and expect to get the services being hired without them saying, well, we actually could take their money and not do the work because they already knew there was this problem.
Well, not if they're the scoundrels, Your Honor. In other words, and you're hypothetical about the architectural firm.
Aren't scoundrels entitled to legal help? I mean, suppose you're indicted for a crime, right? And there's this very large public allegation that you're, and then here insert, say, a securities defrauder. You hire a criminal defense counsel and
Absolutely.
Say, help me out of this. And he doesn't. Can the lawyer then say, look, this guy is a crook. He knew his legal problems.
Absolutely
not. The lawyer
not.
Didn't have to help him.
But the difference here is the law, Illinois, the in pare delicto doctrine, does not allow the scoundrel to basically pass the consequences of his or her misconduct, intentional misconduct, to a third party. I mean, what they essentially want to do, the funds.
That's a question about damages. It's not a. No claim, at least for current purposes, about what the damages are if Winston did not perform its undertaking competently.
Well, that's
I'm just trying to figure out whether it is ever possible for a wrongdoer to hire a lawyer and get good legal services without being met by a defense, you're a wrongdoer, pari delicto, we therefore didn't have to provide good legal services.
You know, of course, Your Honor, in the typical case, a criminal or something is entitled to go to a lawyer and get the legal advice. I think in this case, they are trying to sue the lawyer in this civil lawsuit for all the damages that were incurred as a result of the fraud.
I'm not worried about damages. It may be that the damages are quite unlike what the trustee thinks. I'm just worried about the pari delicto defense.
But I guess
every time I ask a pari delicto question, you try to change the subject. You say, well, the law firm wasn't really hired to provide advice about this, or the damages aren't nearly what the trustee thinks. I want to solve the pari delicto problem.
Right. Well, I think you have to go back to what is the in pari delicto defense rooted in. And it's rooted in the idea that Illinois, in other words, you say, well, that's just a damages issue, but Illinois defines the purpose of the doctrine in the first place. When you're looking to why do we have this doctrine, we want to prevent the wrongdoers from shifting the consequences of their wrongdoing. I don't think that is necessarily it's not a damages issue, it's a liability issue. In other words, the law does not want somebody who is defrauding their investors from saying, you know something, it's actually all the lawyer's fault. And these guys, again, it's not. This morning we heard, well, we did not know about the Ponzi scheme. That's the, and in McGladrey that was critical because the allegation in McGladrey was that the auditors were negligent for not finding the Ponzi scheme. The difference is here, they're alleging the auditors were negligent for not blowing the whistle on their own misconduct. In other words, Judge Easterbrook, to go to your point, what is the duty that they're trying to impose on the lawyers in this case? I think this answers your question. The duty that they're imposing on the lawyers is you failed to blow the whistle on our wrongdoing. It's not like you inadequately helped us get out of our wrongdoing.
Well, that's just another version of the fact we weren't hired to provide legal advice about what to do. And if the complaint is the only thing you had to do was go tell the cops, that's not the lawyer's job. Indeed, given the attorney-client privilege, it's very hard for the lawyers to go tell the cops. That I understand, but it's not pari delicto. If you come back to McGladrey and Pullen, suppose the allegation in McGladrey and Pullen is that Bell had gone to the auditor in that last year and said, oh, by the way, I'm running a Ponzi scheme. How should I account for this in my public filings? Right, and the auditor had then completely fouled up how a Ponzi scheme should be accounted for.
Yeah, I would think that then the funds or Bell could not recover because the law does not aid the people in the perfecting their illegality.
Look, on the hypothetical I gave you, Bell has finally decided to tell the truth, and he wants the help of a professional in truth telling, and the professional fouls up. Why can't somebody who wants to come clean get professional advice about telling the truth?
That might be different, Your Honor, because then the duty that you breach is a duty in coming clean, and there that would not necessarily implicate the same things. I mean, what they are alleging here, though, is
but all of this just suggests to me that pari delicto is thoroughly the wrong way to think about it.
We
should be asking, or you should be asking, or the district court should be asking, What are the lawyer's duties when confronted with knowledge that the client may be committing a wrong? And if the lawyer doesn't carry out those duties, what are the damages?
Your Honor, and we have the alternative argument in this case that there was no duty and that there was no causal breach. So we're entitled to defend the judgment on any ground with support in the record, and we have done so with respect to the kind of issues that Your Honor was describing. Again, the in pari delicto doctrine is typically invoked in this kind of a situation where you have somebody engaged in some kind of a securities fraud, and then they sue the lawyers whom they hired for negligence. I mean,
but
that's the Dublin case.
The application of the doctrine differs depending upon what the nature of the theory of professional liability is. I think that's the import of the questions.
I think that's right.
And so perhaps you should focus on that point and why this particular iteration of professional negligence falls within the doctrine.
Sure, Your Honor. And the point is, they are saying you are liable for in pari delicto because you didn't tell us and give us legal advice about our own wrongdoing. And again, kind of going back to some of the issues that Judge Posner was raising earlier, under Iqbal and Twombly, there is no specific factual allegation that creates any plausible theory that any of this would have made any difference. In terms of going to anybody else, they kind of say in very generic terms, well, Winston should have told an unconflicted representative. They make no allegation about who is an unconflicted representative, what that person would have done. I mean, the whole thing is very implausible when you start looking at it at that level. But again, I think Your Honor's point is a very good rejoinder to, so, or it responds to some of the points that Judge Easterbrook was raising, which is you have to look very specifically at what is it that the plaintiff or the trustee here is saying that the defendant should have done, the law firm should have done. And it's really here they're saying we knew we were intentionally doing all these bad things. Bell told the law firm all these material things that showed that we were deceiving our own investors. And you should have told us what Bell told you. But of course, if, as you established in the earlier case, Bell is the funds, the whole thing is kind of bizarre to say that Bell should have, that Winston should have told the funds what Bell told Winston. It all winds up being kind of caught up in chasing its own tail.
There's no plausible reading of this complaint, which consists of an interpretation that what Bell was asking for was legal advice about how to fix the problem.
We don't think so, Your Honor. And there's no plausible causal story that if Winston had done what the funds say they should have done, that they would have done anything differently, because they were, by their own allegation, I mean, their complaint really depends on Bell knowing all this bad material stuff about how the investors were being duped into making all these investments. For Bell to say, guess what? These core safeguards that you are advertising to the world that you are following are true. I mean, obviously, they knew that. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that you're not supposed to tell investors you have all these protections in place when you don't, particularly when the fund consisted of this one single investment, and these safeguards are so critical. I see my time is about to expire. If there's no further questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Landau. Anything further, Mr. Tomaszewski?
I think we're getting a little ahead of ourselves in this notion that Bell was doing all these bad things at the time it engaged Winston and Strawn. The only allegation is at the time he engaged Winston and Strawn, he told them that the monitoring aspect of the representation was not taking place. And what he got from Winston in response from that was a confidential investment memorandum that said it was. And
in the trustee's view, what concretely should Winston have done?
Well, I think it had a couple of choices, one of which was to draft a confidential investment memorandum that did not contain the representation that Winston knew was not being complied with. I think that's probably the most important thing.
That might be a ground of suit by the investors, but this isn't a suit by the investors. This is a suit by the fund.
Well,
so what should Winston have done from the fund's perspective?
Well, the other principal thing that it should have done is it should have at least attempted to go to someone else at the funds. This is not a question of going outside the client relationship, say to the police, as Your Honor was mentioning, within the funds, to the directors, to the independent investment
officer.
That's
where you hit the Iqbal problem, since it doesn't seem likely that they were independent in any meaningful sense.
They were said to be independent. Winston represented them to be independent. And at this stage, it may turn out to be as a matter of proof that they were just his stooges. But I don't think at this point in the case that you can say that.
Why not?
Because there's no evidence
that
they were.
Well, but you never did a pre-complaint investigation of the most superficial sort, which is simply to find basic biographical information about these directors.
The biographical information is contained in the confidential investment memoranda that Winston drafted. And it says they were all men who worked for the Swiss investment company, I believe, in the Cayman Islands. And they were said to be independent. It was also stated there was an independent investment officer who had the final say on whether any investment should be made.
This appears to be a completely ghostly figure. He kind of drifts in and out of the papers here. Who was this guy? What were his duties?
I'm blanking on his name, but his name is stated in the confidential investment memorandum.
Do you have any reason to believe that he was real?
He certainly was a real person, Your Honor. You know, I believe that the trustee did interview him. I don't think that's in the record, but I believe it's the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.